Thank you very much, Katya. And thanks to you and to the Atwater Library for including me in this venerable reading series. It's great to be here. As you suggested, I lived in Newfoundland for a long time and never tired of exploring that endlessly mysterious and magnificent mini-continent. Near the tip of the Great Northern Peninsula, there's a vast stone plain referred to as the, or known as the Limestone Barrens. And this is a very stark elemental landscape consisting largely of sky, rock, and sea. The peninsula juts up there into the cold Labrador Current. And wandering around on that barren plain, you experience and are aware of vast reaches of space, and your sense of perspective and scale are altered. Things seem unfamiliar and excitingly new. There are some plants growing there, species of trees familiar from further south, such as willows and spruce and alder are present there, but instead of growing up into the air, their morphology is completely different. They grow flat on the rock or in tangled cushions, or they creep along in crevices. Essentially, the air is one vast razor that shaves everything down, and the trees only survive in places where there isn't a wind blowing and ice pellets and salt from the sea aren't scouring them. The first piece I'm going to read has to do with that place, and it's called Notes on Burnt Cape, which is the name for part of that limestone barren. Frost causes rock to boil. Wedging ice into cracks, it splits stones, then slips its water blades deeper in, levers them, spades the gravel up in rolling domes. On the scraped bare cape, each strewn boulder has a wind shadow pointing southeast, a tapered green plant-woven satchel stuffed with silt. Trees, spilt like puzzle pieces, grow their branches down among stones as though into air, and you must lie down to distinguish the crowns of the willows and birch. Sky and sea vault away beyond reckoning. Your car, the road you followed, your house, you have to work to recall. Sometimes, caught in the wind's cold pelt, pure sounds, waves leisurely slosh or thump, gulls high, slow, staccato, brush past the ear like ocean's barbed seeds. Well, you're aware not only of vast reaches of space, but of vast reaches of time, especially biological time, because the rock you're walking on, hundreds of feet thick, is composed of the calcium-rich body parts of dead marine creatures that over many millions of years settled on the floor of an ancient, warm, shallow sea and turned to rock in layers. So it's a kind of archive, really, of the whole evolution of life on Earth. And if you've read a little science, I guess, to sort of bolster your perceptions there, you think about how life began as sort of small, soft-bodied, blind blobs swimming in a warm soup, and then got the idea to develop teeth and shells and so on that would make it easier to eat other little blobs. And what you get is a kind of biological arms race where, of course, you know, the victims develop bigger teeth and bigger shells or thicker shells, and that requires the first group to get even thicker shells and bigger teeth and so on, until eventually it occurs to some creatures that, well, maybe it's better to be very inconspicuous and numerous and not really worth eating and survive that way, or, you know, to be ugly blobs of mush that don't taste good. And so you get that kind of yin-yang dance of hard and soft, armed and unarmed, that goes on and on through history. The role of calcium in evolution. Sweet calcium we found we could live with. Stir into our cells hubbub, tinker into a trellis to carry our fierce red vine, its eyeball blossoms, cunt orchids, cock orchids. We could whittle it into bone stilts and paddles, hooks, tongs, helmets, mallets, cleavers, awls, flutes, rasps, rattles, corsets, folding spokes. But then, oh God, the weight of all these contraptions. Just throw them out and be light. While the old hardware clatters down like Victorian claw foot settees settling in scrap heaps, the ear trumpets, the spurs compressed in archaeological files, we float careless as fruit flies in an armory, all the weight lifted, tra-la. But the dark rock candy of history dissolves in the rain, leaking the diatom's binary code, the lobster's molecular gospel into the water we drink. Sleepless, we pore over things you can make with calcium in cellular braille. As soon as you throw something away, you need the damn thing. Hinged pincers down here somewhere under the catapults and greaves. Tell me how else to deal with the world. I'm going to leave the limestone barrens there for a while and come back to them for two more pieces at the end of my reading. But now I want to turn to a long poem that's in the center of this collection, Lookout, called Once, that has to do with a visit I had with my parents when they were both in their late 80s, almost 90, and it was in the last year of my mother's life. She had fairly advanced Alzheimer's and was unwell in a number of other ways. These are not titled. I'll just read them one after the other. They're pretty much, you know, short poem a page kind of thing. And the other thing I would say about them is that if this was visual art rather than writing, these would be pencil sketches that are intended to just stay as pencil sketches, not as preliminary studies for more elaborately worked up pieces. I wanted to maintain a kind of light touch in this. Wrapped in a shawl on the love seat, my mother smiles to herself a while, then glances across with something important to share. And for the third time this morning, tells the story of her fear of starving when the car's axle broke on a lonely country road. I cried and cried, she says, still half embarrassed by her theatrics. I thought we'd be stuck for days, and my father got so mad at me. Can't blame him, my father remarks from the other couch. She gives an amused snort, jauntily folding her sweater's frayed cuffs, and follows her story beyond where it's gone before. Her father's parents lived in Tavistock. That's where they were headed. Her grandfather, Adam, who'd emigrated from Germany, was an angry, miserable man. Oh, he hated us, she says, her eyes live as flame. The neighbor's lawnmower roars and recedes. My mother sleeps on the love seat, my father on the couch. I shake out mats on the blinding porch, gather gray tea towels for the laundry. My father bustles stiffly out to plug in the kettle, comes up from the cellar with chunks of maple, measuring, figuring how to make wooden nuts and bolts. Then is suddenly sunk in an armchair, open-mouthed asleep, while June sunlight storms through the house. Along with the recent past, the worries and duties that kept her fixing and pleasing are gone. Calmly, she orders him to open the curtains, find her slippers, fetch her a small dish of strawberry ice cream. He jokes that he has to serve her smartly these days, and she answers flatly that she's done a lot of serving over the years. Without apology, she indulges her pleasures, and he is doting and patient, almost equally changed.